Hi, everyone. Welcome back. I'm Michael Sandler, your host on Inspire Nation. Have you ever felt angry, afraid, or don't understand why in the world you act or react the way you do? Then do we have the It Didn't Start With You show for you. Today, I'll be talking with Mark Wallin, founder and director of the Family Constellation Institute and the author of what I consider a must-read book, particularly if you have or are thinking of having children, It Didn't Start With You. And that's just what I want to talk with Mark about today, about how inherited family traumas shape who we are and what we do and how to end the cycle once and for all. That plus we'll talk about rats and traumas, mice and cherry blossoms, gaining sight, and what in the world Hansel and Gretel have to do with anything. So welcome to the show, Mark. Are you ready to shine?
Hi, Michael. Thank you for having me. I'm ready.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And before we dive right into things, I wonder if we can take us back in time. Can you tell us what you were like up to about age 34 and then what in the world happened?
I would say I was blind prior to 34, but not physically. Mm-hmm. I couldn't really look inside myself very deeply. And then something happened. I began to lose the vision in one of my eyes, literally. And I was diagnosed with a chronic form of retinopathy for which there was no cure. And the way it was progressing, the doctors told me that I would likely lose the vision in my other eye as well. And I was pretty panicked. And everything I was trying at this point, supplements, hands-on healing, juice fast, everything I did seemed to make it work. And at one point, I just gave up, really. And I gave away my business and left my city and started to go east, pretty far east. I think I ended up as far as Indonesia, where I studied with some wise spiritual teachers. Here I am now sitting at the feet of gurus and fasting for days at a time and meditating for days. And in fact, during this time, I remember a 3-day-a-night meditation on a cushion about this big, and you couldn't sleep. And
this
worse,
is the one that you were blindfolded?
Yeah, worse, you're blindfolded and you've earplugged. So it's completely blocking out everything but the mind. And well, that's what the goal of the craziness was, to come to know the craziness of the mind, which I got pretty intimate with. And I saw that my mind played out worst case scenario thinking, that if I could just think the worst thing, somehow this would immunize me from my fears and terrors, because my worst fear, and hold this language, because we're going to get back to language. My worst fear was coming true, that I'll go blind. I won't be able to take care of myself. I'll be all alone and I'll be ruined. This language would be the key to my healing. I didn't know it at the time. I just can't see. Here I am on these cushions. And finally, I was having a spiritual meeting with one of the teachers, and I waited in line all day. I think you had to wear a particular white sarong or robe or something. And by the time it was my turn, 8 hours later, I got to the front, and you know, I'm thinking I'm about 2 steps away from enlightenment, and that he's going to crown me meditator of the year. Instead,
ego.
Right, exactly. Instead, he looked right at me. What I should say is, he looks right through me, and he sees what I couldn't see. And he said, "Go home and heal your relationship with your parents." He said, literally, "Go home and call your parents." Well, I was livid, because I traded my parents in for better parents, spiritual parents, higher parents. So I thought, I'll just get another satsang with an even greater teacher, and I did. I found some other guy who imbued hundreds of people all day with his heavenly love, and I'm waiting in line again. And Michael, the exact same thing. I get to the front of the line, and the guy looks right at me, and again, right through me, and says, "Go home and make peace with your parent." Well, luckily, this time I listened. All the meditating, made me feel whole inside, but there were still empty, the blind spot. And one of those blind spots is manifested physically. So I figure, how am I going to heal this? My relationship with my parents was pretty broken. I had a break in the bond with my mom. I had no idea how this was going to happen. And then I didn't know this at the time, but in hindsight, I had to heal what stood in the way, which was inherited family trauma. Specifically, the fact that all of my grandparents were orphaned in some way. Three of them lost their moms when they were babies, and the fourth lost her dad when she was one, a baby, and ultimately her mom's attention. And this feeling of being broken from a mother's love, this is what had passed forward in my family for generations. And anxiety, terror, fear, that was the real cause of my vision loss.
So you go home, and I imagine your gut is kind of twisting in two, because reunions with your mom, I think, are anything but easy. How was that first hug?
Yeah, well, I felt like being squeezed by a bear trap, and I was terrified that she was going to hug me. I hadn't seen her in months, and maybe even longer than that. And she would hold me, and I would turn into a steel. Well, that's exactly what happened. But because of all the meditation I had done, I learned to stay with what was intolerable, stay with what was uncomfortable. And in doing so, when the hug ended, I said to my mom, Mom, keep holding me, because I wanted to learn from inside where I was tightening, where I was shutting down. And I kept following it. And, for weeks I would visit her, but I would stay open and notice what was intolerable, but stay with it. And to the point where I in weeks and months to come, fell back in love with my mom. Mm-hmm. It was no longer personal. I realized that we were all broken from a mother's love in our family. In fact, there's a quick story. I remember being 5 years old, running into my mother's room whenever she'd leave the house and pulling open her drawers and crying into her nightgowns and scarves, thinking that I'd never see her again, that all I would have left would be her scent. Well, in reality, that's all my grandparents did have left when their mothers died, just the scent. And so the terror...
So pause you for a second. I was fascinated. Your mom did the same thing with her mom as well.
I said to my mom 40 years later, Mom, I used to go into your room. And she said, oh, honey, I can't believe you did that too. I did the same thing. And then it goes even further. My sister, reading the book a few months ago, said to me, honey, did you do that too? I used to cry into mom's clothes. And I realized we all did. It was a generational pattern from this break in the bond of the orphans. And the feeling of the orphans was passed forward.
Let's thank you so much for sharing. Let's go from there. I want to stay with your story just a little bit. And something you said, let's come back to. Mm. And I myself was, my mom said I was a bonehead. I was a forcep baby with some pretty strong force in the forcep. You talked about a feeling of being, and you just mentioned it before, ruined. And you mentioned also when, quote, birthing new project.
Mm. Thank you for that. It's one of those places in the book where I make this connection. I'm a forceps baby too. So not only do I inherit this feeling of being broken from my mother's love as she felt, as my father broken from his mother's love, and it does come down. And later we'll talk about the science, how that literally happens. But also there are many instances in utero and during my birth and after my birth. I'll just tell that one. I'm a very long labor, days, and then I'm a forceps baby. And my head was concave and crushed. So here's this feeling of being birthed into the world and expanding into a crushing, into a being ruined. And now we don't remember that with our hippocampus, but our amygdala-driven trauma brain remembers this. And so that feeling of, if I expand, I will be ruined. I carried that through my life until I could make these connections. The end of the story is my eyesight comes back. I didn't even look for my eyesight to come back, quite frankly, Michael. I was okay no matter what my eye was doing. But in doing all this healing work and looking inward and developing a different type of vision, I never meant to create a healing path for people with inherited family trauma. It's quite by accident. But in doing all this work, my vision came back 2020, and then I felt compelled to teach people what I had learned, these principles. And that's why I wrote this book, really.
It's beautiful. And from what I understand, the physician saw your eye, and it's completely scarred over it. You shouldn't be able to see, but you've basically found a way to bend light.
Well, you know, we don't know, but I go to the ophthalmologist, and he said, can you see this? I said, sure, E, F, that's a G. And he shakes his head, he scratches his head, and he says, but your retina, it's all scarred. You shouldn't be able to see that. And then he postulates that, oh yeah, the light signals are bouncing off the side of your head. It's okay.
I love it.
But I do see.
Let's go from there then, and let's jump into traumas. And and this actually goes back to birthing in the canal, in a sense, because you talk about a well-documented feature of traumas is the inability to articulate in words what happened to us.
You know, we lose our words. The language centers of the brain become compromised. Not only that, during a trauma, the connection to the prefrontal cortex and the hippocampus, which helps us to remember what happens, kind of goes wonky. And so we don't have our clear memories, but we also don't have the language. Something goes awry with our language. We often can't talk about what happens. And in my book, I again and again and again help people uncover this trauma language, what I call core language, because it is core. Remember my sentences going back, I'll go blind. Now, I won't be able to take care of myself. I'll be all alone. I'll be ruined. Well, this is the language of orphan. I won't be able to take care of myself. I'm all alone and I'll be ruined. And that feeling, and that's how sometimes we feel without a connection to our parent, that there's something inside us that's broken. And the idea of the book is to make these links so people can see that it didn't start with you is very likely.
So let's go from there and talk about Rachel Yehuda, if I have her name right, Mount Sinai School of Medicine and PTSD.
Yeah, scientists have long suspected that we've been connected with these traumas, but there wasn't the evidence until about 10 or so years ago. Rachel Yehuda, she's a pioneer of Mount Sinai Medical in New York, and she discovered that Holocaust survivors and their children share the same trauma symptom, specifically the low levels of cortisol, which is the hormone that gets us back to normal after a stressful event. The low levels of cortisol that the Holocaust survivor and the children share, which can lead to symptoms of PTSD, depression, anxiety. And then she does this other study as well, which is a very famous study, that the children, the babies born to mother who were at or near the World Trade Center when it was attacked during 9/11, who went on to develop PTSD, their children, the babies had PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, 16 different genetic markers. Then just last year, to me, this is the crowning study. She discovers that survivors and their parents share the exact exact same gene changes in the exact same region of the exact same gene. Technically, for people who like gene names, it's the FKBP5 gene, but it's involved in stress regulation. Imagine that we share the same gene. I mean, this totally tells me that, it's quite striking.
So going from there, and this really brought it all together, and my wife, Jessica, she's the producer of the show. I ran in the other room as I'm reading this, and I'm like, I never thought about this, that the egg cell, her egg cells, for instance, for someday having our children, were present in her grandma, if only just as seed cells. So whatever trauma grandma experienced, great-grandma for our newbie someday, goes right down the line.
There are several different ways we can be affected. Yes, that's true, and embryologists have known this for 100 years, that when our mother was in grandmom's womb, and she was 5 months a fetus, the egg that would become us is also present in grandma's womb, in mother's womb, so we would know something about the traumas just at that level, just from sharing the same biological environment. And then we've got the work of Bruce Lipton, mother's emotions, mother's fears, mother's sadnesses, mother's grief. This also is transmitted to the fetus, and the baby feels as the mother feels. And then we have, of course, the epigenetics, which are these traumas that cause gene changes to help the species, the next generation, survive. Gives us a skill set. And so we can be, let me go back.
Yeah.
One thing Rachel Yehuda says, which I love, I want to mention, then I'll talk about trauma. She says that you and I are 3 times more likely to have post-traumatic stress disorder if one of our parents had PTSD. And as a result, we're likely to struggle with depression and anxiety. That is striking.
You talk about it as a mismatch, and it sounds like an amygdala mismatch. We're really getting prepared for the gorilla that may or may not have attacked our mom or grandmom or somebody in the past. But since there ain't no gorilla, we're in real trouble.
Beautifully put. That's right. So when a trauma happens, it literally changes us. It causes a chemical reaction in our DNA called an epigenetic tag, a chemical tag. And this chemical tag communicates to the cell to use or to ignore a certain gene. And ultimately, so we have a survivor skill set, a skill set to deal with the same trauma, which made this chemical change in our DNA. Trauma happens, change happens. Now we're beginning to act and feel a different way because of these gene changes. And the way we act and feel is preparatory. It's an adaptation to prepare us. We're dealing with these traumas that occurred, like you said, the gorilla that attacked grandma or mom, but doesn't appear in our life. So here we are running around with a skill set that can give us more resilience and be helpful, but it can also make us more vulnerable and more reactive and more sensitive. So it can do both things. If, for example, a family comes from war-torn Europe, they can receive a skill set of quicker reaction time and a feeling of how to prepare when there's a loud noise, a gunshot, a bomb. And I would like to be with this person if something were going on that were dangerous, because this person would have that innate skill set. However, many of us are born, and you talk about this mismatch, many of us are born with this being on high alert or hyperarousal or hypoarousal from a trauma that never comes. And this can lead to physiologic issues, even disease, from being on hyperarousal forever.
Let's go from there, and let's talk about maybe a little bit about traumas. And specifically, I'm fascinated by, there's mice studies, and there's studies with pups that are separated from the moms just 3 hours a day. And this is a massive trauma for them.
Yeah, it's amazing. Those mice, they're separated just for the first 2 weeks of life, for 3 hours a day. And this is the work of Isabelle Monsuit at the Zurich Brain Institute at the University of Zurich. And they discover that just that little bit, 3 hours a day for 2 weeks, that these mice begin to show symptoms of depression. And as they age, the symptoms got worse. And what was uncanny is some of the male mice didn't express the symptoms themselves, but appeared to epigenetically transmit these symptoms to the female pup. That is startling.
Well, you talk about it as having a compounding effect. It gets worse for the first 3 or 4 generations.
Well, you see, we have the human studies with Rachel Yehuda, but human studies are limited in the sense that a generation in humans is 20 years, but a generation in mice is 12 to 20 weeks. So we can study the brains, the blood. You mentioned in the beginning the cherry blossom. So I'm going to take your lead and tell this cherry blossom study, Michael. So one of my favorite studies happened at the Emory Medical in Atlanta, led by Brian Dia. And they take innocent little mice, male mice, and shock the little buggers every time they smell this cherry blossom scent. So they introduce the scent, mm-hmm. and then they shock these mice, and then they open the brains and blood, and they see physiologic changes. So the brains are already epigenetically preparing. The brains are enlarged to contain more smell receptors, so these mice can detect that smell now at lesser concentrations, already at a preparatory, an adaptation is occurring. And there's changes in the blood and in the sperm. Well, they take that sperm and they put it into female mice that aren't shocked. And then they look at the male pups again. The startling thing, Michael, in the NECTU generation, without even being shocked, just by having the smell of cherry blossoms introduced, the pup in the second and third generation start becoming jittery and anxious and jumpy and freaking out as though they're going to be shocked, which shows that not only the trauma response, the fear response, the response to the fear also gets passed down. Michael, that's us. We have a response to fear that aren't always ours. We walk around with anxiety. We walk around with a mystery. We walk around with unexplained symptoms, depressions we can never get to the bottom of. Anxiety, a sudden onset of anxiety, let's say that occurs at a particular age or when we go to have children. I once worked with this woman. She had no anxiety, Michael, until she became pregnant. And now she's consumed with anxiety. And I'm looking at the big picture, the whole gestalt, and I'm thinking, why just when she's pregnant? So I use some of the questions I outline in the book. And we discovered that she had a horrific fear of harming her newborn baby. And that this horrific fear was so powerful in her. She never knew she had this fear. She just had anxiety. But when she began to go inside and pick it apart. So knowing this, I said, tell me, anybody in your family ever harm a baby? And she said, no. This is how far away it was. No. And then she went, oh my goodness. She said, my grandmother, when she was a young woman, she lit a candle and the curtains caught on fire and the house caught on fire. Her baby was upstairs. She could not get her newborn out of the house and the baby died. And then she said, and we were never allowed to talk about it. And for me, that's a buzzer. When these traumas stay unresolved, when there's a lot of secrecy or a lot of pushing away or rejection of the people involved, or the traumas just repeat, like in my family, broken bond, broken bond, broken bond, but no mother or no child knew what to do until this generation to heal this.
I'm thinking about, you have a term, family consciousness. And then early in the book, you talk about a gentleman, Jesse, who had insomnia, who came in to see you. Maybe we can go there for a minute.
Yeah. There's so many startling cases in the book. Jesse was connected with her father's older brother, who died at 19, and he never knew about this, because they didn't talk about this brother. And this brother was checking power lines in the snow up in the Northwest Territories of Alaska, up in Yellowknife, very far north. And he died in a blizzard. But the father never talked about his brother because the grief was so great. I think the father was 13 or 14, and he loved his older brother, who was 19, and never talked about this. Jesse, at age 19, starts shivering at night in his bed, and he is in terrible insomnia, and he's freezing. And I ask, what's the thought? What do you think? Because I always get people's what I call core language. What are you thinking right before you shiver when you can't fall asleep? And he said, if I go to sleep, something terrible will happen. That's all he knows. Well, that is what happened to his uncle. The uncle went to sleep and died. And this is in the father, who's the 13th. This trauma is the father's trauma. It is etched, imprinted in the father's DNA. And we don't know the exact mechanism, Michael. We really don't know. We just know that it happens. You know, I mentioned three or four mechanisms in my book about what we're looking at right now. There's a high incidence of microRNAs. This is the small non-coding RNA that regulates gene expression. So people can have a high incidence of this or a low incidence of this after a trauma. I believe low, maybe just high. That I know for sure. Or DNA methylation. DNA methylation is when a protein is blocked from attaching to the DNA, which silences a gene. Or there's effect to the CFR1 gene or CFR2 gene. You know, there's different mechanisms, but every day they're learning more and more. We just know it happens. And I'm grateful for the work of people like Isabel Monsui and Rachel Yehuda and Brian Diaz and these people who are coming out with these studies and telling us finally, because many of us have no clue when we suffer that we're not the problem. We walk around, I swear, Michael, I see this all the time. We walk around people saying all the time, yeah, it's just the way I am. It's just how I'm wired. That's the way I am. I'm just numb. I was born this way. And the question is, are you sure? Are you sure you were born this way? And the book takes people and turns them into detective looking at this language. In fact, what I do and the reason I wrote this book is I can't work with everybody in the world, but I wrote a book which is like working with me one-on-one, where you learn to become a detective of your trauma language and hear this language. And then you link it to the events in your family history that people aren't talking about that have never healed. And then the last third of the book is designed to have the new experiences and healing practices so we can change our brain.
So let's go from there and talk about what Hansel and Gretel and a trail of breadcrumbs has to do with anything and what we do with this information this information.
That's the part that most excites me. Thank you. So I've discovered that when a trauma happens, clues are left behind. Remember, we talked about earlier how the language centers of the brain are compromised. So when a trauma happens, this language kind of disperses in fragments or gets lost, but it's never lost. It just sips into the unconscious and reemerges in different ways, especially in our worst fear. So one of the questions I like to ask people is, you know, tell me what's the worst thing that could happen to you if your life suddenly came undone, if things suddenly fell apart. What's your worst fear? You know, that's one of the questions questions that can bring up some of this trauma language. These are the breadcrumb of the unconscious. So if you learn to follow this trauma language, if you learn to follow it, you'll hear it in your life all over the place. The way you describe your parents, the way you describe your relationship, the way you describe your relationship to life, to success, to abundance, to yourself, really. You know, when we have these traumas, we're blocked really from inward looking in many ways.
What I find really cool about this is the importance of languaging, and really, this is where parsing really comes into play. So if somebody says, I will be destroyed, I don't know, I'm just pulling that out of the air. I will be destroyed. If we go back then in their family tree, chances are something along the destruction lines actually took place.
Michael, that sentence can go two places.
Yes.
And I love it. But I'm so used to hearing these sentences. But yes, someone was destroyed in his or her life. Someone was destroyed in his or her marriage. Someone was destroyed in his or her career, in the family tree, in the family history. Or in utero, an event, a very traumatic happened at birth, you know, like the forceps, because my sentence, I'll be ruined, is not much different than that. In fact, that can go here, or it can also harken back to events in the family history. And I make that point in my book. We're either looking at language that was born in utero from traumatic events that happened before we even had a hippocampus that could help discern what was happening, and more likely, the events in the family history going back to our parents and grandparents, and sometimes even our great-grandparents, where things happened, and this language that isn't ours lives in us. There's another case I talk about in the book about this woman who was going to take her life, and she used the strangest sentence. She said, I said, how are you going to take your life? And she said, I'm going to vaporize myself. And of course, my jaw dropped open. I said, vaporize yourself? How are you going to do that? And she said, well, my brother or brother-in-law or cousin, I forget, works in the steel mill, and I'm going to go into the steel mill, and I'm going to leap into one of those vats of molten steel. And then she used this word, and my body will incinerate before it reaches the bottom in seconds. And I'm hearing those two words, vaporize and incinerate, but because of what I know about language, I key into those words, and I'm thinking vaporize, incinerate. Well, it could be a fire, it could be a holocaust. Oh, holocaust. So I'm looking at her blonde hair, blue eyes, and yeah. I'm thinking, I don't know. Well, anybody in your family ever involved in the holocaust in either direction, either in some way responsible or in some way had experience? And she went, no. And then she said, oh, wait a minute, my grandmother was Jewish before she married my Polish grandfather, who was Catholic, and she became Catholic. And I said, when was that? She said, 1946. And I said, what happened to her in 1945? She said, well, she just got out of Auschwitz, where her whole family got killed. They perished in the oven. And I said, wait a minute, did you hear what you said and what you said? And, you know, later on, she reported to me that language, vaporized and incinerated, tracked through her, but wasn't from her. It was her grandmother's language, the fear of living when everyone else had died, and the language of all those who had died.
I don't know how to say it when we have the Holocaust almost in the same sentence, but this is the coolest thing. This is the coolest thing in helping us get at the core, no pun intended, and we'll get there, of what's going on. Maybe before we talk about the core and how we can start to heal ourselves, can you share with us a little bit about the four unconscious themes?
Yeah, thank you. So what I've observed, there are four ways that act on us unconsciously. And that's why, I mean, there are many ways that we're changed. But I call these the four unconscious themes because the effects are unconscious. Number one, we've merged with the life experience of a parent. So dad fails at 40, and somewhere around 40, we begin to fail. Mom gives away her first child, and we abort our first child. Dad and mom's marriage ends in the 30s. And in our 30s, all of a sudden, we look at our partner and we feel distant, would not realize that we have an unconscious effect of this merged relationship. That's number one. Okay. Number two, we've rejected a parent. And when we reject a parent, like many of us do, we reject aspects of ourselves in that parent, that behavior. If our mom's cold, we can't see when we're cold. So unconsciously, the behavior, even though we say, I will never be like my mother, we very much can't see it. That it will express in us unconsciously because the behavior is disowned in us. Not only that, we look at our partner and we wait for our partner to be cold. We're already waiting for what we got. So we're projecting that behavior onto other people. And probably the worst part is if our mother was cold or critical, who are we cold or critical to? If our mom's critical, we're inwardly critical. If our dad's aggressive, we're inwardly aggressive. And so the effects of rejecting a parent have these unconscious effects in us, that too.
I want to pause you on two just for a brief second. I don't want to tangent too much, but what fascinated me in this part of the book was that traditional healing modalities with psychiatry and psychology, traditional, were going to rehash or almost blame a parent for what happened to you. And it actually, you in that sense, cut them off even more and make things even worse.
Well, yes, but there's not all blame the parents, but a good portion do. And we're like rats in a maze because many times we are taught that what happened to us, in other words, we're kept further away from healing these relationships with our parents. And it's essential that we heal because in a way, the parents are a template. If we look at it, they're a spiritual template. They are they're seen. They are for us the first God in a way. And when we look at our spiritual disciplines, the deities are always off often perceived as mother, father, God, mother, Mary. I mean, many of the disciplines. It's almost a patriarchal or matriarchal feeling, the divine mother, the spiritual mother, all these things. But we can't do a spiritual bypass, or what I like to say, a maternal bypass. We've got to go back and heal that relationship with her. And I teach that in the book. I teach how to get something from our parents, even when very little was given. So that's number two. We reject a parent, and then we reject aspects of ourselves unconsciously, project it unconsciously onto another person, or reject the little child, the fragmented parts of us that really need to integrate. And we'll talk about how we heal later. Third, we talked about the four unconscious themes. We have a break in the bond with our mother, like I had. And we, in a way, we're held together with tightness and anxiety. When a mother looks at us, literally it's through the gaze in her eyes that we come to have a self. But when there's a broken trust and we start to develop otherwise without a connection with her, we stop trusting the feeling of who we are, because it's our mother who first gives us that feeling of who we are through seeing us, through mirroring us, through bonding with us. So breaks in the bonds often show up in our relationships. We get close to somebody and then we get terrified they're going to leave. It's that come close, push away feeling. Often we experience anxiety whenever we have distance or closeness in a relationship. And the fourth theme, the most interesting one, Michael, is we're identified with someone in the family like Jesse, other than the parent, like an uncle, like a grandparent, like a stillborn brother, that we're living dead like the brother that nobody will talk about. And we're feeling like we don't belong in the family, or that no one sees us like that brother. And there's an identification. And that my book talks a lot about these identifications because they're quite common and they're quite intriguing.
You mentioned a violent boy, Todd, started stabbing his couch at age 9.
Yeah. His grandfather, and he didn't know this, right? His grandfather was in a barroom brawl and stabbed a man to death. And here's this behavior repeated in a 9-year-old boy. And it wasn't until his father started to ask questions, or maybe the father knew, I forget the details, but when the father told Todd, a feeling in both the father and in Todd could finally come to rest. And now we're bridging into how we heal, really. The how do we heal? Well, we've got to, am I ready for this? There are more questions?
Yes. No, let's do this.
Because it's big. We've got to have a new experience that is larger than the old trauma feelings, the old trauma cycle, the old stress response that's running inside so many of us. Defend, don't, no, stop, don't, because this trauma cycle is trying to protect us. It's doing its job, but it's also keeping us from vulnerability and intimacy and closeness and relationships and connection. We've got to have an experience larger that can overshadow in some ways the trauma feelings by having meaning or salience to us, relevance to us, this new experience. So I'll get back to this experience in a minute. And then we need to practice the new feeling and the new sensation of this new experience. And every time we practice the new feeling, and this can be a feeling of receiving comfort or support, or it can be a gratitude practice or a generosity practice, or it can be extreme feelings of compassion or loving kindness. But we stay in the practice till we really absorb, till we really integrate and install this new experience we're having and the new sensations. When that happens, we are pulling away, stripping away traction from the amygdala and bringing engagement to the prefrontal cortex, which is where we integrate the new experience in our body and where we can begin to heal, literally by laying new neural pathways down in our brain.
Neuroplasticity,
right. Our brains are plastic. Great book, Norman Doidge, The Brain That Changes Itself. All these people to now talking about we can change this brain. Absolutely. But when we practice these new feelings, not only are we wiring aspects of two sections of the brain that were not wired together originally, Hebb's law of neuroplasticity, what fires together ultimately has a chance to wire together. But the more we practice and the more we focus, we get these areas of the brain to synchronize. Literally, the dendrites of one area start to move into the dendrites of another, and we have these synaptic synchronized areas of the brains that are now connected and wired together that are linked. So every time we feel this, we also feel this. Not only that, not only do areas of our brain begin to wire together in a new way, but we also have the release of feel-good neurotransmitter like serotonin and dopamine, or feel-good hormone like oxytocin released in our body. And not only that, last thing, but our genes, the way they express, especially our genes involved in stress regulation, can begin to move in a new way. We can make an epigenetic change. But we've got to practice and repeat.
Before we practice and repeat.
And focus, practice, repeat.
Focus, practice, repeat. And we have to have awareness. So I wonder if we can talk just a little bit about either the core complaint or core descriptors and even the core sentence, because we have to do some homework to really know what's going on.
Yeah. So that's what I do in this book. I turn people into self-detectives. And, you know, you're going to open that book. You cannot help but become your own detective and look at everything you say. And I ask you to listen again to your complaints in a way. And I have these exercises. exercises that are designed to get you to hear yourself in a new way. And I also ask you to describe people and to hear yourself in a new way. And then I ask you, like earlier I mentioned, the, one of my things would have people do the core sentence to describe their worst fear. This is key.
I wrote mine down.
Oh, you did?
My absolute worst fear is I'll screw up everything and be a loser or be a bum. And I laugh when I'm saying that because it hits to the core, but it sounds so absurd.
No, it actually can go two places. It's brilliant, actually. It's these sentences, that's a great one. That can go to someone in the family who failed and who lost the respect of other people, a father, a grandfather, etc. That's where that can go. And where it can go in an early experience in utero is if we fail giving what we believe our mom wants, we feel like we failed and we lost her attunement, which comes from the break in the bond that I have. So it can come both places.
That led to a second sentence I wrote down that I go, okay, why do I have a second sentence if I've already got my core sentence? But the second sentence, and this is pretty strong, is you don't deserve to live.
Wow. Wow. Now that sentence takes me back into the family, Michael. That who messed up, who failed, who lost everything, who disappointed people, who couldn't protect their children, who gave away children, you know, all those sorts of things. And you've probably figured it out. But
I haven't, but I know I have a feeling which side of it, the family it is. And I've heard similar language from others in my family. So I know I can't take ownership. But actually, it's interesting because while right now I'm talking on a very intellectual level, particularly in my early years before I did a lot of work, and it sounds like I have a lot more work to do. We'll get on this. From your book, it's pretty awesome. But in the darkest moment when intellect and words shut off, these words flash up on the dashboard and you take complete ownership of
them. Absolutely. So well put. So well put. That's right. When we start to disappear from ourselves, when we lose connection with ourselves, sometimes all we have connection with is this trauma language. And that's why it's so important that we look at this trauma language, because it's linked to things. And when we can make the link to where this trauma language lives in our family, and I then help people do the core trauma and their genogram, their family tree, all this stuff. When we can make the link and see where this language belongs, then we can break the cycle. Yeah.
And that's huge. So what is a genogram? I was fascinated by
it. It's a two-dimensional representation of our family tree. And when you lay out a genogram, you can literally see, I ask people to not just put the people in, but the traumas. I have them turn it into a traumagram. And when they put the traumas, they can start seeing a line that goes, oh my gosh, my father felt that and he did this. And his father felt that and he did this. And we can start seeing the way these traumas move through the family history and affect us, our siblings, our children. Yeah.
So then going into healing a bit, how do we start to make peace with our family history?
Good question. Well, first of all, we need to shake the family tree. So what can, I don't mean to be trite, but what can fall out gets to fall out. All the secrets that remain hidden, all the healing that never fully took place, all the grieving that couldn't be grieved, all the stories that didn't get told, but we kind of know them. We heard about them once or twice, and then that was it. These things need to be brought to the surface, and then we need to do our work around them, which is am I affected by these stories? And then when we do our work around these things, we need to talk about these traumas in the family. We need to, go ahead, yes.
This is a question Jessica asked me earlier as we were discussing this. What about for people who were either adopted or don't have anybody left in the family to go back to?
Yeah, absolutely. You'll still find it because it's in your language, in your behaviors, in your actions, and that's what the book does. Even if you don't know what it is because your parents are deceased, or your parents will not talk, or you've been adopted and don't know your parent, you will know what happened because you will know your trauma language and you will look at the patterns of what you keep attracting to you.
Thank you. What are a personal healing sentence?
No. So a healing sentence. And so in the last section of the book, what I do is I lay out these practices that help our brains change. And our brains change, again, through focused attention, through repetition, through practice. And one of the things I have people practice or say would be a sentence that really moves them. For example, someone who got very little from a mother could say these words to herself. Mom, I know, when she knows that, once she knows the trauma, the story. So for example, once she knows that mother was given away, it's like, of course I didn't get the love I needed. It's no longer personal. And the healing sentence could be, Mom, I know if you had gotten more from your mother, from grandma, you would have given me more. But because you didn't, I'm learning to give it to myself. And when I do that, this is how I honor you.
I like the word honoring, because in all of this, you're honoring your family, but you're especially honoring yourself.
Absolutely.
Can you tell us about the importance of rituals and practices, and maybe we'll call them honoring rituals?
Yeah, that's pretty much what they are. They're practices where we honor or we connect with that part of us that was fragmented in a trauma. And we all have it. This part of us, some people call it the inner child. For me, that has to be localized in the body so we can feel where. So I direct people, where is that fragmented part, that child part, that young part of us that fragmented during a trauma, or that biologically we inherited from our mother or father's trauma. So once we able to integrate this part of us, and there's a lot of work I do in the book about how to integrate this fragmentation, and many ways to do it. Everything from having a boundary. I talk about a practice in there, how to have a boundary, to putting a photo of a deceased parent over our shoulder, to writing a letter, to lighting a candle. I mean, this, I list so many of them in the book. But these rituals, these practices, bring us back to ourselves and ultimately can bring us back to a parent, even when very little was given. And I always get the question, yeah, but I'd really crap parents. And I get that question all the time. And I always say, well, never throw yourself in front of a moving train. Don't do it. Because until the inner work is done, for example, if I didn't have those years of meditation, I couldn't have been hugged by my mother. I'd have freaked out. But I had done the inner work where there was no chart. All it was is mother holding me, body stuff arising. So never throw yourself in front of a moving train, because that's not a good thing to do. However, when you have enough distance for self-reflection, ask some questions. What happened to your mother that made her hurtful? What happened to your father that made him drink or critical? What happened? And when we start to build this landscape, Michael, of understanding, we open the door of compassion. And when we open the door of compassion, both for ourselves, for what it must have been like when we were little, for them, because that's, we now know what happened to them too, the trauma that happened to them. We now deal with something called peace, understanding, compassion, peace. And that's what we're all looking for, this inner peace.
Woo-hoo. So maybe we can talk real briefly about the core language of relationship. Maybe we start with Tyler, who gets married and immediately had a beautiful romance going with his wife and immediately has feelings she's going to leave him and cheat with him within 6 months and bedroom time is over.
That's beautiful. Since he's been married, he was not able to make love to his wife since the wedding. And he, but I think two times or something, he tried. And the trauma language, the core language was, she'll cheat on me within 6 months. And it was so specific that I said, could you go ask your mom and your dad? They're not together. Yeah, I know. Can you go ask your mom and your dad if anything happened in the early marriage? And sure enough, he found out that on both sides, actually, even though I think I just mentioned one side in the book, his father's side, he found out his father walked in, came home from the factory early and walked in on his wife cheating within 6 months. And he left town and he never came back. And he was brokenhearted. He went on to marry Tyler's mother, but his heart wasn't full because he was still reeling from the trauma that got imprinted, inscripted in his DNA, that you will leave. And now his son is carrying, you will leave, you will cheat. And it also existed on his mom's side too. She was cheated on when she was pregnant. So it was crazy. These traumas come from somewhere. We carry the language. And that's the point, Michael, that I make in this book again and again. Well, let's look at this language, because we're walking around saying it, but not saying it. We're telling it, but not showing it.
Then what's the language of success?
No. Well, there's many of us that have language of success. I could mention so many cases that I talk about in the book. I'll lose everything would be a sentence. I can't. Someone with a break in a bond, afraid of being rejected, stays small. I can't think off the top of my head, but there are so, one of them is the example of I can't keep money after I have it. I squander it or it never really comes to me. And sometimes I've seen that someone in the family cheated somebody and someone in a generation later pays a consequence by not being able to keep the money they have because someone cheated someone in the generation before out of money that wasn't rightfully theirs or they got a wrongful inheritance. I give all the 20 dynamics of the things that we look at in the book when we have issues around relationships, when we have issues around success. Yeah.
One of the common ones, I barely have enough or I'm just surviving.
Yeah. That was a case I remember of. And I remember that case now that you bring it up. Ben was an attorney and he had this, he was ready to close his practice because that's what he kept telling me. I'm barely surviving. I barely have enough. I'm barely surviving. And of course I heard this language of who is barely surviving or who barely has enough, is barely surviving. And we found out his grandfather owned a plantation and used migrant workers and paid them next to nothing. And the family grew filthy rich, but the workers lived in dilapidated shack and starved, and they lived in absolute poverty. And he remembers playing with those kids when he was small. And he carried, well, from many different ways, that feeling of I identified with them and barely surviving. I barely have enough. And it wasn't until he had to make good. He did some work for people. One of his rituals, one of his practices was to give to people who had nothing and take take a couple cases of people who couldn't pay him. And in doing so, he kept his doors open and became successful.
Yeah. But as we begin to wind things down here, is there a spiritual component or where does spirituality fit in?
Yeah. You know, Michael, I believe that these traumas have a spiritual component. I believe that the reason that they resurface is because they want to heal. It's almost inside, homeopathically, inside the very trauma is, of course, the seed of healing that needs to be discovered. It's something I say in my book, actually. I say that trauma language is the seed of the trauma, but it's also the seed of the healing language. And really it is. But these traumas want to, we are contracted in a trauma and our true movement is toward expansion. And we want to heal, these traumas beyond us, the spirituality of the trauma wants to heal, to move out of contraction into expansion. So they keep repeating. And it's not a mistake. It is till somebody opens the door and lets the trauma in and says, I will look at you. I will be with you. I will be with your feelings that arise. I will be with those that have been pushed away in this trauma. I won't exclude anybody from my heart. And that, to me, is very spiritual.
Powerful. And that is also, which is very spiritual, self-love. The willingness to say, I will heal once and for all by throwing light something I've stuffed in a closet. My parents or their grandparents have stuffed in the closet. And I'm gonna go for it, even if it hurts.
Beautiful. Beautifully put.
So, do you have any words of wisdom for parents to help their kids?
I do.
When it comes to, thank you.
Yeah, I do. Tell your kid what happened. Tell them, especially if they're suffering or struggling in a way that is a mystery to you. Tell them what happened to your parents. We have a fantasy that we immunize the next generation by not telling, that if I keep this a secret, I'm protecting my children. Well, it seems to work converse to that. That the more we push something away, the more we ignore the traumas, the more they come back to haunt us. But the more we explore them, the more we don't have to repeat them. Tell your kids what happened and then help your children do some of these practices that I lay out in the book. They can be life changers. I've been doing them for 20 plus years with my clients and they work.
Thank you. And it sounds like if somebody is considering conceiving or raising kids, that it'd be good to go pull a few strings on this sweater as well and see where it leads for healing even before that time comes.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I think if we're going to have kids, it's an obligation to look at our past, our parents' past, and then reveal to our children so they're not living a mystery. They know what the mystery is.
Thank. So where can people go to find your beautiful book and to find out more? And this is in my top 10 list. This is one of my, I don't know if I can use the word favorite because it's not the easiest, lightest read, but I'm going to say one of the most important reads out there because I think if you have a pulse, you have something in here to go hunting for.
Absolutely. And I wrote that book for that reason because we struggle with these mysteries and can't explain them. People can find it, of course, on Amazon. It's published by Viking Penguin. They can go to my website. My website is www.markwolynn.com. Markwolynn.com.
And if you're driving down the road and you didn't catch that, come on over to InspireNationShow.com and we'll get you over to Mark as well. So Mark, any last words of wisdom you want to share with people today?
Wow, I think we covered so many. Thank you for having me. I think that just open the door, shake the family tree. Don't exclude anybody. Try not to reject your parents. Try not to hide from what's uncomfortable. Open the door.
Well, thank you so much, Mark. This has been a true joy, and I think it's going to be a healing experience for so many out. So for everyone out there, this is Michael Sandler saying, be well, have fun, get it didn't start with you, but no, it can end with you, and shine bright.
Woohoo! Thank you, Michael.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Michael, thank you. This was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed, not only did you make it easy for me, you made it beautiful for me. Just connecting with you, you're a beautiful guy, and your spirit is just lovely. I could talk to you all day long. I want to thank you for that.
Thanks so much for watching. If you enjoyed it, be sure to like below. Also, leave your comments. Have some real fun with it. Subscribe to our channel where you're going to get more great videos, more interviews coming up. And check out our website, InspireNationShow.com. That's where you'll find tips, blogs, information, videos you won't find anywhere else, and useful and helpful resources to really help you kickstart your life and to shine bright. Thanks so much again. Thank you for your support. Like, comment, subscribe. See the website. Thanks so much and have fun. Of course, shine bright. Woohoo!